You are listening to The Healthy Living Code, a podcast created for active people of the triangle who value their health and will do anything to protect it. Before we begin, if you currently suffer from pain, head over to thepainreliefbook.com and download a copy of our free book, How to Get Rid of Pain and Back to Living an Active Life Without Pain Medications, Injections, and Surgery. Now here's your host, the owner of Kaizen Physical Therapy, Dr. Derek Nielsen.
Welcome to our next episode of the Healthy Living Code. I've got Dr. Annis, who is the owner of Unorthodoc here in Carrboro, North Carolina. So tell the listeners and myself a little bit about what, where you come from, where you went to school, and what made you decide to open up practice here in Carrboro, and more about the type of setting that you're in as well.
Right. Well, I guess I'll get to it in a minute. Unorthodoc is a really different model for practicing healthcare. But I got here because I've been led here probably since the moment I became aware that I wanted to be a doctor. And you can actually see that in my baby pictures. You go all the way back to, you know, my earliest pictures, and I was making little hospitals for my dolls and, you know, chasing my dogs around to, you know, pretending that I was giving them shots, and which they were imminently patient for. But I wanted to be a doctor since as young as I can remember. But because I was growing up in the late 50s, early 60s, I was getting told fairly frequently that that probably wasn't going to happen because I was a girl, you know, and I thought, oh, yeah, no. that's not going to happen that way. For a little while, I bought into that myth, and I went to nursing school, which I hated. No offense to nurses, but it was not the job for me, and became a med tech. And then I found physician's assistant program, which I thought, well, that's close. That's really close to being a doctor. And I went and I did that, and I loved it, except that back in the 80s when I was a physician's assistant, the doctor supervision was much closer than it tends to be today. So I would spend hours making relationships with patients only to have a doctor swoop in and tell us what we were going to do as a result of that relationship. And I found I just really didn't like it. And I couldn't quite put my finger on the why. A few years into that, I one day was complaining to my husband about, you know, what was the difference between me and a doctor. And, you know, I mean, they just were more persistent at their education than I had been. And why did they have to, you know, mess with my relationships? And suddenly my husband said, it's time for you to do something or stop complaining. and he went back to his, actually, he said it much more poetically than that, but I can't put that out for public consumption. But he basically took away all of the props I had that were kind of keeping me from doing something that admittedly was going to be hard and expensive, but that I knew I had to do. And so at the age of 30, I went back to medical school, but I got to go back to medical school already knowing what it was like. Having been a PA, I knew what it was like to be in a room with a person who didn't have their clothes on and make that situation comfortable and deal with all that. So that was a hurdle I didn't have to get over when I went to medical school. So medical school was just one great big, you know, cerebral party for me. I just got to enjoy the learning of it, you know, now. And it was a grind, but it was doing stuff that I was really passionate about. I ended up doing my residency, my medical school at Medical College of Georgia, and my residency at Duke. And then I came out and did several different kinds of work. I've always been self-employed, as a physician, but, I met a doctor here in Carrboro in the late 1990s that I started working for, and he and I got together with one other doctor, Dr. George Dodds, Dr. Nick Sarter, and I, a rebranded Carrboro Pediatrics and Internal Medicine, which is the practice next door. And I worked there, I worked there until 2015. And then it became apparent early in, around 2010, 2011, that the insurance model, that insurance had come to be an overbearing force on healthcare that was, not just it wasn't just, you know, sucking up people's privacy and getting into everybody's business. It was starting to actually change the way doctors practice. And I at some point, I just couldn't serve two masters. I wanted to go in a room and have my patient's agenda be the only thing in front of me. And instead, I knew that the whatever card they flashed out at the front desk, whatever insurance card they flashed at the front desk, that was who I was actually working for, because that's who was paying me. And it became real clear to me that he who pays the piper gets to call the tune. And I started chafing against that. And then we had a particular run-in with one of the big insurance companies that demanded that we refund them a very large sum of money for something they said that we weren't doing right, even though we had followed all the guidelines. They didn't give us any advice on how to do it, so we followed all the guidelines that Medicare would have required. We used Medicare guidelines, and they said, nope, not good enough. You didn't follow our guidelines, and so you owe us $20,000.
Wow.
Just out of the blue. And all of a sudden, when I realized that we had no recourse in this, you know, that this was basically part of the contracts that we signed, part of what was expected, that they could just walk in and say, yep, nope, you haven't been doing this right. We begged and pleaded, we fought, we proved, we went to the nth degree trying to overturn this. And in the end, we ended up having to give them $20,000. And on the day they called me to tell me that there was no wiggle room in this case, I said, thank you. You just made the hardest decision of my life really, really easy. Because I recognized that there's no safety in that model if they can do that at any time. You know, if they can just basically walk into independent doctor's offices are like mom and pop shops. You know, we don't keep $20,000 laying around for the, you know, when the insurance company gallops up and demands it. So I said, this is not a safe way for me to continue to practice medicine. I do not want to put my retirement, I don't want to lay my retirement in these people's hands. And so I had been thinking about doing something like Unorthodox, and that was the day that's the day I knew I was going to do it. So, and I have never looked back. Once we opened and people started coming through the door and people started, you know, paying us, you know, instead of their insurance companies paying us, I started to once again understand what my value is in patients' lives. And sometimes I get choked up when I start to talk about it, because it really, you know, I mean, you just don't know what you're missing until you know what you're missing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, my patients have, you know, helped me probably way more than I've helped them. But I did say I was going to get back to the model of direct primary care. And I think I'll stop there and see if you want to ask a question before I go
on. I've got so many questions. So I know a lot of people in my field of physical therapy, they get burnt out. Mm-hmm. I've got friends that I went to school with, and they're just seeing so many people at one time that they're getting burnt out. Is that a similar feeling that you, I mean, minus the $20,000, I mean, that's a huge hit. Mm-hmm. But is there a burnout factor in the care that you were giving before you opened up Unorthodox?
Yes, there's, you know, and the funny thing is that my model of how you take care of patients has always been the same. It was the same when carbopediatrics and internal medicine opened. It's the same now. It's this idea that if you give me enough time in a room with a patient, I can figure out what they need. I can help them figure out what they need. And I can save them money. I can save them time. I can make them safer, healthier, happier, you know, more satisfied with their care. And when we first opened carbopediatrics and internal medicine, that's exactly what we tried to do. We didn't have that many insurance companies on board, and for these exact reasons. And then people, you know, loved us, and more people wanted to join us, but they couldn't. They felt like they couldn't join us because we didn't take their insurance. And before we knew it, we were on everybody's panel, and we were like, you know, one of the favorite doctor's offices for people to come to, because we were giving insurance, we were giving care like old-fashioned doctors, but having to do it under the reality of an insurance-based healthcare. And in order to do that, to pay the overhead that you have to pay in order to fight the fight that you have to fight with insurance on a daily basis. We had a lot, we have, you know, had lots of staff that we had to pay just to grab the last crying dime out of the insurance company. And that, you know, and it was like, that meant we had to work harder. We had to see more patients. We had to keep seeing more patients. We had to keep bringing people in. We were not, we couldn't stop. We couldn't adjust ourselves to the ever shrinking number of dollars that the insurance companies were putting into our pockets. And, you know, I mean, in the end, when you're running a doctor's office, you are running a business, but we didn't, you know, we didn't, I got to the place where the business that we were running felt like it was eating us alive. Not the patient care, but the fact that we had to do it in such a volume that it wasn't fun. And not only was it not fun anymore, it was getting dangerous. You know, when you see, I mean, it feels dangerous when you have to see 25, 30 patients a day, you know, to make ends meet. It's like, you don't have time to consider all the complexities. And I just got to the place where I didn't feel like the job that I was doing was a job that I was, you know, that I was happy to do. And I felt like everything was being dragged out of me. And when I wasn't seeing patients, I was doing paperwork. I was paperwork, and more paperwork. And the burden of the paperwork for doctors was just getting higher and higher.
And it takes away from the patient.
It takes away from the patient. Everything that I'm asked to do by any other person other than the patient takes away, takes the attention away from my taking care of them. And that, you know, it's really interesting. If you just let me, if you just set me down in a room with a patient, we will figure it out. You know, and if you don't put any record-keeping tasks on me, secretarial tasks on me, you know, to have to gather data from for someone else who's going to profit from it, not me, you know. But if you take all of that away that doesn't have anything to do with patient care, doctors would have a lot more time, and patients would be a lot safer and happier, you know, and a lot more heard. There would be a lot less waste in the system. When you aren't being paid for what you're worth, when you as a physician aren't being paid for what you're worth, for the work you're actually doing, your inclination is to, let's say you have a patient with diabetes. Well, any good primary care doctor should be able to manage diabetes. But if you're seeing a patient in 10-minute increments or 15-minute increments, your inclination is to send that person to a diabetic specialist to be managed rather than doing the basic meat and potatoes of diabetes management yourself. You know, you can only do 5 things in an environment where patients are being rushed past you at a fevered pace. You can write a prescription, you can send them to a specialist, you can order a study, you can send them to the emergency room or admit them to the hospital. That's basically it. You know, and I guess there's the other alternative, which is tell them you don't have time for that problem today, they'll have to make another appointment. You know, which is probably my least favorite of all of those. Although it's the one that does the least harm. So the system is now set up to ensure that people actually leave the primary care doctor's office where they should be getting most of their care and end up in something that is more expensive, more narrow in scope, if they're at a specialist's office. And basically lose having someone at the center of the wheel helping them control all of these various aspects of their healthcare. So it's like we've gone wrong somewhere using our primary care physicians that way. Pretty much most healthcare should stop at the primary care doctor's office if the doctor actually had time to do it.
Mm-hmm. Really quickly, I want you to define direct primary care.
Okay, great. Direct primary care, when I started this, I don't think there was a name for this movement. Okay, I mean, I just wanted to figure out how to get back to a very direct relationship between me and my patients, and the only way to do that is to have my patients pay me directly. But there, it like all other good ideas, usually when a good idea arises, it tends to arise in several places at the same time. And it turned out that there were doctors all over this country who were having the same wake-up call and thinking about how can we get back to how can we get all of these middlemen out of the exam room and get back to paying our having a direct relationship with our patients? And direct primary care is a is the answer to that. And I want to separate it from concierge care. Often when I say something about direct primary care, which is basically a membership practice, people say, "Oh, it's concierge care," and I'm like, Not exactly, because concierge medicine kind of came into being as a way of a lot of concierge practices still will take your insurance and take a large sum of money from you to help manage all of that, so that it has kind of felt like moving people to the head of the line rather than flattening the playing field so everybody gets a chance. So if you're going to call direct primary care concierge medicine, then you have to call it blue collar concierge medicine, because the price is kept purposefully. The price is kept low and accessible. For example, in our office, an adult pays $54 a month and $20 a visit for their membership with us, and in that is included all of their urgent care, all of their all of their physicals and preventive care, their follow-ups. You know, if I'm following them for diabetes or some kind of chronic condition, that stuff is all included in there. And the reason I opted to have the $20 a visit, $20 a visit instead of nothing, some practices will charge more for their monthly membership and not charge for the visit. That would require going into some complexity about North Carolina insurance law, but it is, I do it the way I do it, so that I can always demonstrate that an orthodox could pay its bills, that I don't lose money on any one of my patients, because interestingly enough, if you are at a point, or if you're in a position where you could lose money on your patients, you are by definition in North Carolina considered an insurance product, and you have to be regulated by the insurance commission, and I would find that really, really painfully ironic. So at any rate, but there are many doctors in this immediate area and all over the country now. I mean, we number in the thousands now across the United States, who are adopting this same model. And the important part about it, the membership part of it, is what's really important, as opposed to, say, just paying a doctor cash for showing up when you're sick. You know, this is even distinguished from cash-based practices. Because in a membership practice where you and I establish a relationship and you basically put me on retainer to take care of your health, what happens in that environment is it actually puts the incentives incentives in the patient's direction, because it means the better you do, the better I do, as opposed to the current model that we have set up right now, which is the fee-for-service model, where, you know, when you're sick, the model that we have right now is actually encourages doctors to weight their care towards your illness rather than your health, you know, despite all the discussions in healthcare about promoting health and prevention, and it's still, you know, doctors get paid the most for you showing up sick and for them handling problems. And it's not that doctors want to do it that way, it's the way that the incentives are set up. So the direct primary care model is a completely opposite model, in that if I do a really good job of taking care of you, if I teach you how to know when you need to come to the doctor, if I give you information so that you can handle some of the minor stuff yourself without having to come to the doctor, it means you spend less time in my office. You know, it means that you keep more $20 visit fees in your pocket. And it means that I then have some room to take care of people who are sicker than you are, you know, or who might need more of my attention than you do at any given moment, and that shifts back and forth. But I am incentivized to do the best job I can with you, because the less you need me, the better I do, you know. And so I have every incentive in the world to work for your best health. And even universal health care, which I have been a big supporter of universal health care for a long, long time. The only problem is it's the same model, it's just the government pays for it. It's still a fee-for-service type model, and the doctor ends up doing better. I mean, the doctor is incentivized to see you when you're sick rather than keep you well. And that's, you know, if we're going to pay doctors for illness, we're going to get illness. You know, if we're going to pay doctors for health, we're likely to get health.
Right. So I just want to recap that is you're saying that you are incentivized to keep people healthy mm-hmm. because they pay what you call the retainer fee.
Mm-hmm. A membership.
Uh-huh. A membership fee, which mm-hmm. is kind of locked in monthly. Mm-hmm. And then they pay a $20 visit. So if they don't show up, you still get that membership fee. Mm-hmm. And then so you're incentivized to keep them healthy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and I have, you know, it's really an it's really interesting in the I came across an interesting point of psychology when we opened this, because I have two ways that you can pay me. One is the, you know, a monthly fee, and the other is to pay me yearly, but you get a 10% discount for paying me yearly. So, you know, whereas an adult right now would be paying me $54 a month, if they paid me annually, it would break down to $49 a month. But if they pay me yearly, the thing that's so funny about the psychology of it is the folks who pay me yearly usually, you know, sign up and pay their yearly membership, and then they come in and they get their physical, and we do a whole lot of stuff, pull in a lot of their old records, and, you know, I really spend a lot of time with them setting up their chart and getting to know them and making sure I've got their information correct and making sure that we know where we are in their arc of health. And, you know, and then, you know, if I've done my job well after, you know, a couple months of that sort of stuff, they don't need me again until it's time for their next physical. They know that I'm here, but they don't need me again. And so this whole time they feel like they're the member of this club, you know, because they're not, there's no more coming out of their checking account, you know, because they paid me annually. Now, I do exactly the same kind of work for people who come in monthly. That's one of the reasons I had to do Unorthodox, because I can't be a different doctor based on who pays me or how they pay me. So that was why the insurance industry didn't work for me. But if someone comes in, if someone pays me monthly, but they've come in and they've had that same deep dive, exact same care, and then I do my job, 6 months later, when they're still paying their $54 a month, it's still coming out, and they haven't been to the doctor in a while, they'll ask me, why should I sign up again? I haven't been to the doctor in almost a year. And then, you know, I remind them that you've had a personal staff behind you essentially the entire year. If you've needed us, we've been here. You just didn't need us. Isn't that great? You know, and you know how to get hold of us. All of the patients have our secure text line, so we communicate with patients by text, by phone, by pager, by video visit if they want, and for some of my patients who are homebound, we do home visits. So, I said, so we've been here the whole time, but isn't that great that you didn't need us? Now, maybe next year you'll have problems where we need to see you very regularly. I hope not, but maybe we will, and we'll be there then too. You know, so, but the people who pay us on an annual basis feel like they're getting away with something, you know, when they don't come in. They feel like, oh, they put in all that money and they got all that service and that felt like the right proportion. And then for a whole other year, they don't have to pay for any doctor visits. So they're, you know, they're happy. And I just never expected that. I never expected to see that kind of psychology at work here. But it's like, yep, you know, people just tend to be more satisfied when they pay annually. So I'm like, okay, pay annually. It doesn't change the kind of doctoring you get. And, you know, but we have that ability. We have some people who couldn't pull together a year at a time, and they're really happy to pay $54 a month and, you know, and $20 a visit. And I'm happy with the regular cash flow.
So it's not out of network. Like, you wouldn't bill insurance out of network, correct?
I don't interact with the insurance companies at all.
Okay.
So I don't even have the ability to submit to them. My computer equipment doesn't even go there.
Perfect.
So, yeah. So basically, everything about my patients stays in house.
And so, what are some of the most common, you know, common things that you deal with?
Oh, well, everything a primary care doctor would, you know. I am a board certified internist and pediatrician, so I joke that, you know, when you ask me what age patients do I see, it's basically cradle to grave as long as you're not pregnant. It's not that I don't, you know, I take care of pregnant people too, but I just don't manage pregnancies. That's a whole nother specialty. So, other than that, one way of looking at internal medicine and pediatrics is kind of like, I'm kind of like an overtrained family practitioner because I love taking care of families. Taking care of children in the context of taking care of an entire family has always seemed so much easier to me than just being a straight up pediatrician where the parents are not my patients. Because I get the opportunity to impact the entire family, with healthcare decisions and whatever, you know, if I'm able to get a parent to change a habit, then I've changed a habit for an entire family. And that is, you know, that's good work. That's higher leverage work. And because I spend anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour with all of my patients, I have the time to talk about, well, how would we change this habit? You know, I don't just say, here, go on a diet, throw papers at somebody and walk out of the room,
yeah.
You know, because it's just not that simple. You know, I'm a big believer in science and statistics and probabilities and all of the rest of that, but only to the degree that it actually helps this unique human being that's sitting in front of me get what it is they need to feel better and do better and live longer and, you know, achieve the goals they want to achieve in their lives.
Yeah, perfect. So you, I think you had on your website that you said you're not taking people that are 50 years in age.
Not now. I have a cap for this practice of 600 patients, and the 50 and above demographic filled up like lickety split. It was lightning, you know. So I have a very set quota of age groups in order to keep the age groups spread out across my practice. And so in 2 years ago in January, we closed to patients 65 and older. Last year, we closed to patients 50 and older. Because I have all of that demographic that the practice can bear. If you see adults and children, you have to carefully curate the number of adults you have in the practice, or the adults end up squeezing the children out. Pediatrics completely rises and falls on the ability to do urgent care. And if you cannot see folks when their kid is sick, you are not of use to them. And for pediatrics, the thing that I really love about the way we do this practice is we try really hard for parents to get in the same day, not just get in the same day, but get in the same day with their own doctor. Okay, now there's only one of me here, but that was something that we started at Carbo Pediatrics and Internal Medicine too, is we tried really hard to make sure that every doctor had enough space that they could get their sick kids in on the same day and see their own doctor. And I work really hard to keep that in this practice, and you know, all the sick kids who came in today are people that contacted me last night. You know, so, and the one was actually about 30 minutes before she showed up, she got put on the schedule. So that in order to do that, I have to not have my schedule completely full of adults. So, you know, don't get me wrong. I love my middle-aged patients and above. I'm in that demographic, as a matter of fact. I have closed to my own demographic, you know, but I didn't have to convince those folks of the value of having a doctor who knew them. You know, who I'm really interested in convincing are millennials. You know, people who didn't grow up seeing the same doctor over and over again. You know, people who are getting their health care sporadically at urgent cares and stuff like that, or online telehealth. You know, it's like, that is, you know, it's really good that there's some place for people to go, but that is in no way any kind of coordinated care, and it's certainly not safer and healthier if the person you're seeing doesn't know you, you know, and doesn't particularly care to know you. As a matter of fact, they're set up to not know you at all. They're just going to take care of your problem and boot you out the door. So it's been a big eye-opening experience for a lot of my younger patients who've never had an ongoing relationship with the same doctor.
Yeah, so what do you recommend? I think I saw someone on your website about, you talked about insurance, and you know, it's not like you tell people not to have insurance.
All right.
But what do you recommend, without overstepping boundaries, but what do you recommend for people with insurance, and if they were to come and see you, what would you say to somebody?
Well, I'm definitely not anti-insurance. I just think primary care shouldn't be run by insurance. Insurance is for every other aspect of our lives, insurance is something that protects us against catastrophe and financial ruin. And that's what insurance companies are good at, is, you know, pooling a bunch of people's money so that it's there when somebody has a catastrophe. And that's how insurance companies are built, and that's how insurance companies are set up. They are not set up to care for a population of people and see that they all stay healthy. That is not their job, especially not if they have shareholders. You know, so the having those, here's, you know, what's ridiculous. It would be like telling State Farm for their auto insurance customers that State Farm was now responsible for paying for oil changes, gas, and tire alignments. Can you imagine what it would be like if you went into the gas station? There's no price posted outside. You take out your State Farm card, you stick it in the pump, you pump your gas, you have no idea how much money you've just spent, and 4 months later you get a bill telling you, we're only going to pay for this much gas because you bought it on Tuesday and you didn't hold your tongue right, and, you know, whatever. You know, imagine how ridiculous and how expensive car insurance would be if we had insurance taking care of those things. So I have patients who have no insurance at all. I have patients who have very high deductible insurance, and that's probably the biggest number of patients in the practice. And I have patients who have gold-plated insurance who literally could go anywhere they want to. They have everything paid for. Ironically, they're mostly physicians. But they come to me because they may have great insurance, but they're still going to get the same 7-minute visit. You know, they come to me and pay to see me so that they actually get a half an hour to an hour of my time, you know. The patients who come to see me are patients who actually want to see their doctor's eyes looking at them during the interview rather than down at their computer. And I'm really happy to be that doctor. Really happy to be that doctor. I think I got off track. Oh, insurance, yes. I think that that I encourage my patients to have insurance. But the interesting thing is that if they, and I think I prove this model the best with patients who have high deductible insurance. It's only like 93% of people never meet their deductible in any given year. Okay, now that's a whole lot of money staying at the insurance company. But if you have a $10,000 deductible and you go have a procedure like something simple like an x-ray, okay, and you whip out your insurance card and you pay the fee for that x-ray, you're probably going to be billed. You're going to end up paying a couple of $100 for an x-ray that I know where to get it for you for $75 in cash. You're going to pay a couple of $100 because that's what the insurance company negotiated with the radiologist. But because you've got this big deductible, now you have to pay the rate that the insurance company negotiated rather than what it's actually worth. I don't know, but that strikes me as dumb.
Right.
You know, especially if you can spend and spend and spend and you're still not going to hit that $10,000 limit unless you have a car accident or you're diagnosed with cancer or you have an appendix burst, you know, or God forbid. You know, and then, you know, if you end up with a $100,000 hospital bill and all you have to pay is $10,000, now that's a lot, but that's way better than having to pay a $100,000 hospital bill, mm-hmm. You know. So I try and have my patients look differently at the way they use insurance. And if I can help them not have to, you know, waste a whole lot of money on that, the space between where my care stops and insurance starts, if they don't have to waste a whole lot of money in here on their prescriptions and their x-rays and their mammograms and their, you know, urgent care visits and stuff like that, I end up saving those folks a crap ton of money. And somebody usually has to go through one or two yearly cycles with me before they realize that if I keep them from going to the emergency room one time in a year, I've paid for myself and more. You know, one time. You know, it's insane to think, you know, how much money we're forking out right now.
And it's not just about money, though, because even though you can save people money, you also get better service and quality of care.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that you can't really put a dollar figure on that.
No, but the dollars, the interesting thing about dollars is that they're measurable.
Right.
You know, quality of care is something that, you know, obviously we've been trying to measure for quite some time. And we keep coming back to measures that have numbers attached to them. It's like, you know, the weight on the scale is doesn't tell the whole story either. You know, 140 pounds is, well, you know, for one person that's great, for one person that's obesity, for one person that means they have cancer because they used to weigh 200. You know, I mean, the number, you know, the hard part is that I don't know that we're in a system where we're trying to measure all these this quality, but I don't know, I guess it's like Jesse Helms said about obscenity, you know when you see it, you know, but you know what quality, you know it when you see it, you know when you feel it.
Right. It's up to the individual.
It's up to the individual. And I'm, you know, I mean, there are some objective measures of quality, don't get me wrong. But when I talk about money, it's just that it's the easiest thing to count, you know. But I'll tell you what, there is no money that replaces the way I feel when somebody walks in and instead of saying, "You're on my insurance plan, Dr. Annis," they take out their checkbook and they write me a check and they say, "I choose you, Dr. Annis. Trust me, that is the immediate cure for burnout. I choose you, Dr. Annis." And yeah, those are the kinds of things that make me, you know, well up, because there is no replacement for it. If every doctor, I wish that I could actually bottle the juice that I get from this work and give it to every doctor I know, because if they tasted this one time, if they drove to work one morning feeling the way I do every day when I come to work, there would be no primary care shortage. There would be no primary care doctor shortage. There would be no burnout. You know, there would be happy patients that would be safer and healthier and a healthcare system that made way more sense.
I totally agree, and I love this model. And that's why I reached out to you, because I really do love it. I wasn't, mm-hmm. I'll be honest, I didn't know exactly what direct primary care meant.
Yeah.
But it honestly, it meant exactly what I thought and what you explained it as. Mm-hmm. Do you find, because I actually check people's benefits, insurance benefits as mm-hmm. well, and I would say mm-hmm. 99% of them are unaware of what they even are.
Yeah.
Do you find that as well?
Yes, I do. You know, most people don't know. And I'm not sure that I can blame my patients, because if you've ever tried to read an insurance benefits book, it's probably saying that insurance benefit books are obtuse is a kindness. But the one of the things that I do try to promote better insurance literacy with my patients, because I make it clear to them that I can't stay on top of this for them. I there's no way, you know. And if they've ever asked a doctor in any other model, you know, "What's this going to cost, doc?" I know what the answer they got. The doctor says, "I don't know. That's up to your insurance company." You know. Now, how can doctors help us turn down pull the cost curve down on a national level when that's the answer that they have to give? I don't know. It's up to your insurance company. You know, And yet doctors are being, having a finger wagged at them all the time for wasting money or for not knowing how to turn around the runaway spending in healthcare. How can they when they don't know?
Right.
You know, and, you know, when you can't know, you cannot keep up with it. It is humanly impossible. So I encourage patients to know their benefits the best they can. And, you know, because a lot of my patients are small business owners, I mostly frame this in the knowledge is power kind of, you know, framework. It's like, if you've got me as an advocate and I can tell you how much stuff costs without insurance, mm-hmm. okay, then at least you have some basis of comparison for what happens with insurance. You know, and I make it my business to know what stuff costs without insurance, you know, so that you can decide, you know, whether or not it's a bargain to use your insurance or not. Mm-hmm. You know, I even tell people when it comes to their drug copays, I said, it is possible. You may think you've got a great $10 copay. It is very possible that drug that you're going about to pay $10 for a copay for is actually only cost $3, you know. And the whole system is like that right now.
Right.
You know, and it's like, okay, $7. Who cares? Okay, but you multiply that by, you know, a $75 x-ray versus a $400 x-ray, you know, or a $675 colonoscopy versus a $4,000 colonoscopy. Same procedure, probably same equipment. You know, but it's like, you know, it is crazy. So, you know, one of the things that people just become smarter about how they use their health care by coming to a practice like this, because I make it my business to make sure that they're not overspending on their health care. And if we do come to something that really does, it really makes sense to use their insurance, like say, if they have mental health benefits or they have physical therapy benefits or whatever, it's like, I'm going to look for the people who will give them a good, would give them a good price from a cash basis. But there are so very many folks that I can't keep up with all of them. I usually say, start with your plan's website, you know, and find, you know, put in your location and, you know, look under psychotherapist and get a list of the people that are within a range that you're willing to drive to, then send me the list. And off of that, I can tell you who I think is good. You know, I'm going to have my patients do some of that work for me because God knows, you know, it changes every year, sometimes every 6 months, that information changes. So it's part of my agreement with my patients is that they will shepherd the part of their insurance that they can actually grasp. And I will try really hard to keep them from using it unnecessarily.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, sometimes it's a little bit off topic, but back to the insurance thing is, mm-hmm. I'll check people's benefits and I tell them, hey, this is what it's going to cost. Mm-hmm. And then insurance will turn around and do something completely different than what they told us.
Yep.
And so unfortunately, you know, I have to tell them, and sometimes I have brain lapse and forget to say it. And then it comes back on me, like, mm-hmm. it's, you know, I'm checking mm-hmm. your benefits and trying to be as, you know, as clear as possible with everything. Mm-hmm. But sometimes insurance, like you said, with sometimes an x-ray will cost $75, sometimes it'll be $400. Mm-hmm. You just never know.
Well, it's never going to cost $75 if you're using your insurance, that I guarantee you.
Okay.
I guarantee you that. So, and I think that the trick is for a lot of patients, they don't understand that they're under no legal obligation to use their insurance. You know, they don't have to whip out their insurance card when they go to the radiologist. It's not required. Hmm. You know, they can simply say this is self-pay. I learned that with a lot of my patients, my transgender patients, you know, didn't want their insurance companies to know their business, and they knew it probably wasn't going to get paid for anyway. So they had a lot of times when they would come in and they would pay for their visits that specifically regarded their transgender issues, and they would cash pay for it so that it wouldn't end up as part of their insurance record. That was pre unorthodox, but that's when I started realizing, oh, you're not legally, there's no law that says you have to use your insurance. There was a law that said you had to have it, but there's no law that says you have to use it. You know, now the reverse is not true for you and me as practitioners. If we're contracted with an insurance company, then we're supposed to be due diligence with that contract. We're supposed to be submitting to that company, and you know, so it's one of the reasons that unorthodox isn't contracted with any insurance company, because I'm not held to any of those rules.
Yeah. And you said that you see, you've got 600 patients. Mm-hmm. What's a normal compared to an in-network type clinic? What would they
2,500 patients. That's modest. You know, if you went to UNC or Duke, you know, yeah, it's a lot. And it's a lot of 15-minute visits.
And you've been in that model of 2,500, right?
I have actually, no. Carbopediatrics and internal medicine. I was in it during my training, and I have visited it from time to time when I did some what they call locum tenens, where I was, you know, actually hired in for a week to take care of people, you know, take care of patients when folks were on vacation and that kind of stuff. I've worked in the environment, and I worked in my training. And the practice next door, carbopediatrics and internal medicine, I would venture to say that the most we saw on any given day was probably 25, but that would be at the height of flu season. I mean, this practice keeps the volume down even in an impossible situation. But I think that there are some doctors in that practice now whose panel is 2,000.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, so But the average, like, you know, family practice, you know, at one of the universities, you know, is usually well over 2,500 patients, and that's a lot of people to take care of.
So what is, when somebody comes to see you, and let's say that they need medication, mm-hmm. is that covered underneath?
In as part of their benefits from an orthodox?
Yes.
No, although I have, if I had the space, I actually would dispense from here. Some direct primary care practices do. They actually, you know, dispense medicine also, and they buy it at bulk price and they dispense it at bulk price, okay. you know, so. However, what I do, usually the first thing I do is have people download the GoodRx app on their phones. And before they go get a prescription filled, check it out on GoodRx, which then will tell them what the cost is at many at any chain pharmacy that's within an X mile radius. You put, you know, again, you put in the radius that you're willing to drive and your zip code, and it will tell you what the price of this drug is at CVS, Walgreens, Walmart, Costco, you know, Harris Teeter, blah, blah, blah. And it always starts with the lowest price first. And it's a real education just to do that once, you know, to look at how different the price spread is from the one on the top to the one on the bottom. It's like, how can a drug that costs $7 here cost $40 there? Right. You know, I mean, if you really want to start taking the scales away from your eyes, that's one of them. And it's actually the one I open with when I go to speak to small business groups. It's like, get GoodRx on your phone. Go to your Google on your phone and get GoodRx, and now just put in any medicine. You know,
are there any other tools like that do you use?
There are. There's for procedures, for example, if somebody wants to have a hernia repair or something like that, there's an app called MD Save.
S-A-V-E?
S-A-V-E, right, where you can actually go and look at doctors who've agreed to post their prices for specific procedures and even surgeries online. You can actually even book it and pay for it online, like a hernia repair. Or, you know, I have shown people that. I have yet to see anybody actually take advantage of it, because I think it still feels a little bit weird to book a surgery with a surgeon you haven't met.
Right.
You know, but they also do things like, you know, CT scans and, you know, that kind of stuff is coming. And sometimes the apps are growing at this point faster than I can actually keep track of them. There is a conservative blogger called... Oh, gosh, wait. The Self-Pay Patient is the title of his website that does all kinds of analysis of everything around medicine that is cash-based. You know, and he evaluates certain insurance plans, and I mean, he weighs in on pretty much everything, and he's very pro direct primary care, because, well, anyone who has to pay their own bills for healthcare is very pro direct primary care once they've experienced it, because it's like, it's the only thing that makes sense. It's the only thing you can actually budget for. You know, if you gotta know what stuff costs before you can put it in your budget.
Yeah. And so let's say that somebody is over 50, mm-hmm. and they can't come and see you right now.
Right.
Or they don't live near here.
Mm.
What's some questions that you would say you should be asking the person you're seeing, or, you know, even typing into Google, or what are some things that people should be looking for if they want the highest quality care?
Direct primary care, yeah. Google, you know, remember those three words, because Google can do a really nice search on that kind of stuff. But there are several doctors in this area. Just down the road, Dr. Todd Granger at Primus Healthcare is near Chatham Crossing, I think. And so on 15504 on the way to... 15501 on the way to Pittsburgh, and he's a straight up internist, you know, so all adults all the time. There is a Dr. Stone is an internist in Durham. There are a couple of adult internists in Raleigh, and multiple family practice folks. So I'm just, you know, I don't feel so bad about, you know, the fact that I'm now closed to older patients, because there are other doctors around who are taking older patients, and they're, you know, and it's growing. You know, the more doctors who come into this, the, you know, and they're it feels like they're popping up every day now. I'm getting tapped by somebody saying, I'm just about to open at Briar Creek, or I'm just about to, you know, whatever. I mean, you got any advice?
Out of necessity.
Yeah, just do just do good work. Just get out there and do good work. Love it. Get out there and love it.
So direct primary care really is a term that's coined that you can look for anywhere.
Yes. Now, yes. You know, when I wish I'd known it when I started, because I was just kind of from, it was like, I'm doing a membership practice. You had remarked when you contacted me about the metaphor that this is like community supported agriculture. I actually can't take credit for that. One of my patients told me that, because I was trying to tell her that we're going to have this membership, you know, and people, you know, when they pay the membership, then they're going to have all of this stuff covered. They're going to know that stuff is taken care of, and they don't have to worry about it. And, you know, and she said, oh, this is like community supported agriculture. You join a farm, you know that you're going to get vegetables, you know exactly what you're paying for, and the farmer has a set income that they can rely on, and then they can just turn their attention to farming. You know, and making sure you get your vegetables on a regular basis. And I said, that's exactly what it's like.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about where my income is coming from. It is coming from the people who come through the door, and they're getting fresher, more nourishing health care, and I have a stable income. And I don't have to think about how I'm getting paid. You know, and I don't have to think about the ethics of how I'm getting paid, because it's as ethically virtuous as it can possibly be. Patients want my service, they pay me, I take care of them. If they don't like what I do, they leave, like they should be allowed to, mm-hmm. You know. And, you know, it's so simple and so clean. And, you know, it's really worth getting up for, because the only thing I have when I walk in that room is your agenda and my professional ethics. Those are the two things that meet in that room.
It's the future. It definitely is the future.
I feel like it is. You know, I feel like it is. And I feel like it's the only future we have any control over, because the government and the insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and hospital systems, they don't have any impetus to change this. Now, actually, if the insurance companies knew how much money I save them on a regular basis, they'd be all over us like white on rice. You know, I mean, but I'm participating in a study right now comparing our practice, the Medicare patients who are in our practice, to Medicare patients in, you know, conventional practices in terms of their outcomes. And the data, we're almost at the end of the study, and it looks like in the data, it looks like we're trouncing everybody else's butt in terms of outcomes, you know, quality outcomes. And like, I believe that if you, you know, really give a damn about the person you're taking care of, if you have time to give a damn, you know, if your brain isn't being swallowed up by all this other data that you've got to put out there, then why wouldn't they get better care?
Right.
You know?
Who's, out of curiosity, who's funding it?
Oh, the Medicare thing?
Yeah.
Medicare.
Okay.
CMS. It's the, but the people who are running the study is the Southern Consortium of Hypertension. Oh, gosh. I'm sorry. It's
okay.
Such a, COSEC. It's a, the Consortium of Southern Hypertension Education something. COSEC.
Okay.
Anyway, they're the ones who got the grant, and they're the ones who are, you know, coordinating the study. But it's a Medicare study, so there's just, you know, and people have, you know, criticized direct primary care because they feel like we're taking, you know, we're adding to a terrible primary care shortage, and it's like, you know what? We're not creating the shortage. We're offering the solution. We're offering the solution to keep doctors working longer because they actually love it, and to keep people coming into the profession because they can do something that actually means something to them. You know, for all of the millennial docs out there who need meaning, you know, who need meaning in their work, millennials need meaning in their work. It's like, this is how you do meaning in your work. You know, you take care of real human beings. That's meaning. Mm-hmm. You know, taking care of, you know, gathering data for pharma or for the government or for the insurance company or for the hospital, that I don't care about taking care of that. That data is important, but I'm not the one who should be, you know, tasked with collecting it. I should be gathering all the data on my patients I possibly can, on my human patients, and applying data, and applying the data that comes from outside to their specific situation. That's what they deserve from me.
Yeah. And so, like, If somebody, you know, were considering to come to you, what would you, how would they reach out, or how would they get in contact with you? What's the best way to do that?
Well, they can call us, or they can go to the website, unorthodox.com, and go to our contact page and send us a little hey there. And my assistant Jody will get back with them quickly, and we'll get them set up for their, the first visit we have with patients. We encourage patients to do this. Is free. I can't dispense any medical advice on that visit because we don't have a legal relationship with one another yet. But I want people to come in and ask questions because this model seems weird.
Right.
It seems there's a big learning curve to understanding how this works when we've all been hit over the head with the copay culture for so long. So I want people to ask questions. I want people to look at our website and read it and digest it and find out about direct primary care and come in and ask me intelligent questions. But mostly I want them to see whether or not we fit. I want them to actually feel like this is the right place for them to come before they make that decision. And the interesting thing I have found is that when people come through the door, 85% of them sign up on the way out. You know, and that's a pretty good, no matter what business you are, that's a damn good conversion rate.
Yeah.
So, no, but it's, you know, it is just, it's really satisfying for me to practice that way and I know this is kind of a strange thing. I don't want people to take this on faith. I want people to do their due diligence. I want people to feel like they're involved and empowered by the healthcare decisions that they make. And joining our practice is just one of them. You know, and then hopefully once they join our practice, I can sort of help demystify some of the other hairy areas of healthcare. And, you know, it's just not as hard as we've been led to believe. You know, it just doesn't have to be this hard. We don't need to feed that many middlemen to make the system work.
Yeah. And with the costs being all over the place, it's, you never know.
Yeah. Well, and we see what happens when we leave. This is the thing that worries me about universal care. You see what happens when you leave it to the government to decide how we're going to have a healthcare system.
Yeah,
I'm really looking forward to that system. You know, but you know, the insurance industry can't change this. Pharmaceuticals definitely doesn't want to change it. I'm sure the hospital industry would like to change it, but they don't know how. They're in the center of all these forces, just banging away at them. The only way I can see to change it is for patients and doctors to basically, you know, shake each other's hands and walk out together, you know, and say, look, you know, to the system, now you have to prove to us your value, because where primary care is concerned, I've got my advisor. I've got my trusted advisor. I know what I can do in just my basic day-to-day life and health. Now, if I need something more special than that, you need to prove to me, you system need to prove to me where I need, you know, where I need to go and what it's going to cost when I get there. We need to start making the system tell us the truth. You know, if I can figure out how to take, you know, care from cradle to grave, if I can figure out how to price that in a way that I make a decent living and I you know, I mean, I'm transparent. If patients know I have 600 patients and they know what my monthly and annual fee are, they can pretty much guess, you know, what the gross income for an orthodox, and I have overhead to keep and I have to pay my staff. But it's like, it's all out there. You want to figure out how much I make? You want to figure out what this system is? There it is. It's right there. You can budget it. You can ask questions about it. I have no incentive to keep it behind smoke and mirrors.
Which is the way it should be.
It's the way it should be. And
yes,
it's the way it would be if we let it, you know. But I just don't see any other forces in this, in the healthcare industry, changing in a direction that is favorable for patients, and certainly not changing in a direction that's favorable for primary care physicians. And, you know, so I, you know, if you've got any patients or potential patients who are listening to this who are interested in checking out the direct primary care model, I really encourage them to go to my website and then book a free appointment with me. And go ahead, grill me. You know, I'm still waiting for somebody to tell me how this model is going to fall apart. You know, it's almost 4 years into it now. And, you know, doctors are jumping on this ship by the thousands. It's astonishing.
It's the same in physical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
the out-of-network is becoming a lot bigger. Mm-hmm. And it's because, I'm sure it's because it's kind of the same situation, mm-hmm. where it's just everybody's getting burnt out and mm-hmm. you can't provide what you want to provide and know you can provide.
Right. You know, I just prefer to... I think that that something that is as intimate as healthcare, you know, when you're going to walk into a room and take your clothes off for somebody, you know, that there needs to be a felt sense of purpose between you and your patient, between the patient and the provider, and you know, otherwise it's just so mechanical. There's just, you know, it's unsatisfying. It doesn't feel safe. You know, it's very demoralizing and destabilizing. And I just, you know, I mean, call me sentimental if you want to, but I just see, you know, relationships. I want to work really hard for the people I have relationships with, you know, and I don't want to. I don't want to disappoint people I have relationships with. So why wouldn't you want that? Why wouldn't you as a patient want that?
Yeah, there's no way you wouldn't.
Yeah. And yet we've all settled for it. You know, we've all just kind of, you know, settled for it. And, you know, and my profession, you know, kind of got herded into this alley without, you know, thinking they were doing right by the patients by, you know, let's take this insurance and let's make this easy because, of course, they can't understand it. It's too complicated and we're going to help them out by taking care of this part. And then we'll make sure that's how we'll make sure that we also get paid. And before we knew it, you know, we'd let the vampire in and, you know, this profession is no longer a profession done the way it's being done right now. You know, it's an assembly line and we've gone from a proud, long-standing profession to labor management disputes.
And everybody's confused.
Mm-hmm. And that's just no way to feel. And the industry right now, it keeps running on fear and illness and death. And you know what? That sounds an awful lot like the defense industry. You know, no, you know, not dissing the defense industry. You know, I'm not on this show anyway. But that's not what healthcare is supposed to be. It's not what this is supposed to be. You know, I even bridle at calling it an industry, but it is, you know, at this point. It's just that people shouldn't feel like they're cogs on the assembly line, neither the doctors or the patients. Right. That's the one place where you shouldn't feel that. You can make all kinds of efficiency in the technology of healthcare and the science of healthcare and even in the delivery of a lot of parts of healthcare. But at the very center of it, there's a beating heart, you know, that wants to feel cared for. And, you know, that's where I want to be. That's the fun place to be for me.
Yeah. Melissa, I think we've got to wrap this up, but I really am a fan of this model and I'm in a similar type model myself. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time I've, you know, been in front of somebody that's in direct primary care, so I really do appreciate you allowing me to come in here and interview you. And like
you
said, if you're interested in becoming a patient or even learning more about this model, go ahead and reach out. Unorthodoc.com mm-hmm. is going to be the best way. Is there anywhere else they can find you?
On Facebook and on Twitter. Occasionally, I'm not the best tweeter, and we do have a site on Instagram, but Facebook. I'll just say Facebook.
So is it under the business name?
Yeah, okay. Unorthodox on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate you.
Thank you. I love the opportunity to talk about this stuff. Take care.